Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be interviewing Mr. Greg Johnson, the CEO of a large pen testing firm based in the greater Salt Lake City in Utah. Greg, thanks for taking your time on a wonderful Saturday afternoon, and thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. It's it is a beautiful day today, and what a better day to do a podcast on cybersecurity, right?
Sounds excellent. So let's go and get started. As we know in the world of cybersecurity, there are a lot of tests and a lot of things that can be done in order to ensure that a business or a corporation, that their lines of defenses are up to snuff. One of these tests is what they call a penetration test. I think a lot of people have a general idea or scope of what it is. But being the experienced pen tester that you are, can you go into more detail and like what it really is and like what our audience can glean more from it?
You bet, Ravi. Pen test is a critical part of a good, what I would call, cybersecurity hygiene program. And let's just level set for all of our listeners today. Cybersecurity is not about any one particular thing. It's multi-layered. There's policy. There's procedures. There's endpoint protection. There's SIM. We truly are a cybersecurity company. We do advisement and counseling. But a penetration test is really a real-world simulated attack conducted by a qualified and certified engineer. They know what they're doing. They're able to find the cracks. Where's the water going to flow through, to use an analogy? And then how do you seal it? And so they'll professionally document those vulnerabilities inside and outside, and web applications. We'll talk about the various layers of pen testing. But the objective, Ravi, of a pen test is to find all the holes in the cyber defenses and be able to document how to fix them. That's what a penetration test is, if that makes sense.
Okay. So in a way, and for another example, it's kind of like conducting an angiogram of the heart to kind of see where the blockages are in a way, kind of, right?
Yeah. In fact, I like that vulnerability. Many of us may be walking around with fatty deposits in our aorta as it were, and similarly on a network infrastructure. Even people that say, well, our stuff's in AWS or ours is in the cloud. Well, you have a firewall, don't you? And that firewall, does it not communicate to your public or private cloud? And guess what? There are ports open. There are services behind those ports, whether they're in the cloud or out of the cloud or on-prem or whatever. And let's find those blockages in the aorta and let's figure out how to fix them.
Well, the reason I bring up this kind of analogy is I'm a heart patient myself, too. I had a heart attack and had grafts in there. So that's kind of why this is the best example I use when talking to people about pen testing. I've written my articles about it. It's the easiest way to really understand it. So, but what kind of tools are out there? I know, I've written articles on pen testing. There's a lot of tools out there. Being a pen tester yourself, is there one that you use in particular, or it just depends on the client's circumstance, their requirements? I know.
Go ahead, Robbie.
No. I was just naming just a couple of off the top of my head, but please go ahead.
Yeah. Well, that's a great question, and often I will get asked a similar question by our clients that are interested in pen testing. A lot of times they tend to make it about a scan, and really a pen test. If you think about your car. This morning I took my car into my mechanic because I've been having some weird things going on with the engine. And in he has this amazing toolkit. It's actually a neighbor that works for the Ford racing team. And he's brilliant with regards to mechanics. And if you were to go into his garage, you'd see several of these very expensive, vertical toolkits with the pull-out drawers. He's got wrenches that I don't even know how to tell you what they are. And all kinds of tools, and similarly with penetration tests, there are probably two dozen tools that may be used during the course of a particular penetration test. Let me give you some examples of that. So again, the reason I'm telling you this is it's not so much about the scan, but it's about the craft and the genius of the mechanic that's wielding those tools, right? And just to level set for the listeners, I myself am not the actual pen tester. There are guys in my company that are a lot smarter than I am that I've been working with for many years. My chief partner in crime is my VP of technology, has been doing pen tests for many, many years, has certifications like the CCIS, CISSP, OSCP, SANS certifications, yada, yada, yada. I could go on and on. But that would take up the length of the podcast. The guy is brilliant. And so he's actually the one that coordinates and orchestrates. Another one of my pen testers was one of the specialists, the security specialists at REI for many years. He also ran the penetration testing group at a large organization. Anyway, my point is they're the smart guys doing the test. But over the years, I've learned that there are so many tools. For example, one of our pen testers may use OpenVOS. Now, OpenVOS is a common tool, and it's simply for scanning. If you were to say, Robbie, just run a scan on my external network and see what you find, that's kind of like the first layer of that onion peel, and it would find some vulnerabilities. Well, OpenVOS is a tool that does that. So Kurt, my senior engineer, may run that tool, and he may find some initial vulnerabilities, which he can then start to exploit. But it goes way beyond that. He has a Kali Linux package. Kali Linux has long been known as a common build of Linux that incorporates multiple tools within that package, if you will, scanners and password crackers. Another common brute force password hacker, once he gets either internally into a network and he's trying to see if bad passwords are on a system, might be Jack the Ripper. There's tools called Nikto, a common tool that our testers might use, for example, for a web application, might be Burp Suite. Burp Suite happens to have both paid and free download versions. Listeners on this call that have a web application that they've designed, if they just want a quick, no charge look at it, they can download the free version. And obviously it's limited, but it will find some external app vulnerability. So the tool list is long and wide and broad, and again, it depends on the type of work that they're doing, Robbie. And like the mechanic, you use the appropriate screwdriver wrench, the appropriate head on that wrench, whether it's a Robertson screwdriver or whatever. And similarly, the pen tests are, the testers are going to use the right tool and the right technology for the job. So one thing I'd say about a good pen tester and a good and quality penetration test is that it's not going to be just two or three tools. What I find is that, for example, when Kurt, my lead pen tester, does a large job with internal and external network testing and web applications, he probably will have touched up to 10 different technologies and processes to find as much as he can find before he finishes the project, if that makes sense.
Cool. Sounds excellent. Now, there are other scans that are now becoming popular buzzwords, you know, like threat hunting, vulnerability scans. What is the difference between a pen test, a vulnerability scan, for that matter? How is it different from a threat hunting exercise?
Oh, that's a great question. So first, let's take two of those because they're related. They're of the same family. One's an uncle and one's a cousin, right? So penetration test, again, penetration test you can think of as a real-world simulated attack. So in other words, you've got a real-life hacker that's hacking you. The difference is he's doing it ethically. So he's not going to try to take the system down. He's not going to try to actually exfiltrate it. He just wants to see if he can get there. And then he's going to run exploits. So if you run a scan, And here's the big difference. The cousin called the vulnerability scanner, it's just going to hit that one layer of technology. So in other words, it doesn't authenticate, get into the network, and start poking around. Or once it finds vulnerabilities, it just reports on them. It doesn't say, now I'm going to hit that, attack it, and get further and further and further. And so the vulnerability scan is kind of like that single pass. You know, you plug in your car at the mechanic, again, to use that analogy, and he runs some codes. But until he actually looks under the hood and starts taking things apart and say, oh, man, you've got this component's burnt out, or this brush on your alternator is burnt out, then you don't really know. So that's the difference between the pen test and the scan. The pen test is the deep dive. They'll keep exploiting and documenting until they pretty much found and exploited everything is there is available to find that's of note within an infrastructure or an application. A scan, on the other hand, is just one tool, one technology, like the aforementioned OpenVAS, Nessus, for applications, for example, Burp Suite. So it's using one single tool to scan a particular target or targets for those surface-level vulnerabilities that it can report on. Now, on to threat hunting. Threat hunting is actually like a different family at the family reunion. Threat hunting is more associated with SIM technology and SOC services. So when I say SOC, I mean Security Operations Center. In fact, another company that I'm affiliated with, Secuvant Security Services, runs a full-service SOC. What they do in that SOC is they, A, gather logs from servers, firewalls, and other security-worthy devices and processes, and they feed them into their SIM. A SIM is a Security Information and Event Manager. And they also monitor the live bit stream or mirrored traffic through either a tap or a switch. What am I thinking of? A span port coming off of a switch, right? So they take that rich data, live data and log data, and the SIM and the technology that they use can generate alerts. And those alerts, then they go in and they threat hunt. They look at those alerts, the packets that may have malware or other low-level persistent attacks that might be coming in, and they start to try and put together a picture and determine what's going on with the network. Threat hunting also implies that a trained SOC analyst, so a security operations analyst, usually with at least an A-plus certification, experienced in threat hunting, is going to navigate that SIM, do a search across that elastic index, and come up with anomalies. So, for example, he may go in and say, you know, we had the firewall had 5 authentication attempts from Nigeria back on July 3rd. And so did this other client that we're managing over here. This is interesting. Let's trace that source IP. Let's block it. Let's also cross-correlate it with other threats that came in on a similar day that looked like they may have been spoofed off of other hubs. So you can see that threat hunting is a completely different operation. It really looks for those cyber anomalies within an organization when the correct security operations center and technologies have been stood up to allow those analysts to do so, to do the threat hunting. It's a little bit different.
Mm-hmm. Sounds good. Sounds excellent. Now, just a little bit of a side plugging here. The segue to the next question. Greg Jensen is actually going to be a co-author for our next book on web application security. And I'm very honored to have him contribute a chapter on pen testing. So this kind of leads to our next question. What is the difference between a web application test and a penetration test?
Well, once again, that is a great question, and many folks don't really know what the difference is. So, you know, the objectives are the same as a standard, you know, infrastructure or network test as a web application test, and that is, let's find those cracks where if we were to pour the water on the surface, they're going to flow through and allow us to do some damage. The web application, though, a little bit different. Let's say, for example, on the scanner level, on the tool level, if I just run a Nessus scan without web app plugins, it's not going to find much. It may find that the Microsoft IIS server that it's running on, maybe it needs to be patched. Vulnerability scanners can find that kind of stuff, incidentally, which is why you should have quarterly, if not more than quarterly, vulnerability scans on your infrastructure to make sure all your servers are up to date, right? Because that's where a lot of the vulnerabilities come from. But with a web app, there's got to be special code searching for code flaws. Let me give you an example of that. Web application tools and then the tests that the testers are running are going to take advantage of things like SQL injection. SQL injection is where, of course, you've got the structured query language that runs on common databases like SQL Server and a lot of Oracle's products. And let's say that back-end database can be fooled into thinking that the web application is giving a legitimate query to forward, say, Ravi, your driver's license, right? That's stored in that database. Well, SQL injection errors on the web app on the front end that are presenting that data to unauthenticated or the wrong permissioned persons. If there's a SQL injection error, you can fool that database into saying, oh, okay, this is a legitimate request. I'll go ahead and forward this information. And a lot of web applications have SQL injection errors, where you put in the right gobbledygook-looking code, and it either crashes or causes the server to reveal information that you can then query directly that it shouldn't. There are other kinds of authentication and injection errors. There's cross-site scripting errors, broken authentication and session management errors, insecure direct object references, security misconfigurations of the app itself, and things like cross-site request forgery. Now, someday, and maybe on another deep dive for the technical initiated, Ravi, we can get Kurt on the call, and he can go into such a level that it would put you and I to sleep with each one of these kinds of vulnerabilities, but he can really dive into them. But those are the kinds of things that you look for. So a web app test is a little bit different. Infrastructure network tests, we're looking for outdated firewalls, operating systems, or firmware that's been outdated. We're looking for routing problems. We're looking for things that can be taken advantage of, servers that are misconfigured, ports that are open that don't need to be open. Sometimes we can see unencrypted sensitive data coming either outside the firewall or laterally inside the organization. But a web app, again, we're looking specifically in the web code that's running on that application server that might render it vulnerable. And if I may, Ravi, that brings up another important point. There's so many misconceptions in security, and a client may say, well, we don't need a penetration test. Our code's running in AWS, so it's secure. Or our code is running in Microsoft Azure. It is secure, and we're using Microsoft security layers that they, well, and that may be true, but what people don't realize is that these great vendors, and nothing against Amazon or Microsoft or any other private or public clouds, they do have very strong industrial firewalls. They are, you know, geared to protect against DDoS attacks and other common types of attacks, but what they don't do is they don't scan your code. They don't really care what you put in there. That's your responsibility. So when a company says, hey, you know, our web app's secure because we're running it in AWS, that couldn't be further from the truth. They could have, again, the aforementioned SQL injection problems, where no matter how much security they've got layered around that app, if I fool that application into thinking that a legitimate query is being passed on to the database and I pull Ravi's driver's license, then we've got a problem. And so it's important that at least annually web applications are checked, or as often as there are significant upgrades to check for these kinds of errors.
Excellent. Now, there is often this misnomer or this fallacy in thinking that just because you've passed a penetration test or a web app test, or that you've deployed the latest security technologies like network intrusion devices, firewalls, routers, that you are guaranteed of being not being hacked. But we know that there is no such thing as being 100%, you know, cyberproof. If you do pass the flying colors, can you still be hacked, or are you still safe? I mean, can we explain that in a little bit more detail to our audience?
Yeah, and you know, Ravi, I'm glad you bring that up. That at WebCheck Security, and also at the other company I associate with, we mentioned SOC Services. They're monitoring the network. Both of those companies will say to their clients, "Look, we don't take responsibility for your cybersecurity. Anybody can be hacked at any time. Fundamentally, software." And the software running in the hardware, which we also call firmware, everything boils down to bits and bytes, ones and zeros. And anyone given enough time and resources can disassemble, reverse engineer, and deconstruct those ones and zeros, right? And so there's this also leads to the philosophy that, you know, some companies have with vendors that you got to be careful not to eat the sugar-coated pills, because there's no silver bullet. There's no single product out there that's going to protect you from everything. There's some great product, great endpoint products. There's great SIM products. But you're right, Robbie. Anybody can be hacked at any time. The question is, have we sufficiently implemented cybersecurity in our organization through process, through policy? And I don't mean to skew this off into an overall cybersecurity discussion, but there's so many layers and there's so many different facets having to do with cybersecurity. But certainly, again, often frequent penetration testing and then scanning in between the penetration tests is at least one way to remove the low-hanging fruit from the bad actors, right? And I love that analogy. You know, as a kid, I don't know if you ever, with your friends, if you grew up in a rural or farm area like I did, we could go down alleys in our town or through farmland. And, you know, if there are grapes hanging over the fence or there was a low-hanging apple or a plum off a tree, it's very easy to pick that and eat it. And hacking is the same way. So you want to remove that low-hanging fruit at least, and then knowing that you can still be hacked, have a good incident response policy. So any company should have a plan. How are they going to communicate it? How are they going to remediate it? Do they have a lawyer that they can contact so that everything is under privilege? Do they have a cyber insurer so that they can find out who to call if they need a forensic investigation that the insurance will pay for, and then what remediation costs the insurance will pay for in the event of a cyber event, because that's what you're being insured against, right? So there are these things that we should have in place, given the fact that, yes, anybody can be hacked at any moment.
Well, that brings up another question. Now, being your pen testing team and you, are there any legal documents that you have to sign before you engage a client so that you're protected? Because I know it's one thing to say, hey, I'm a pen tester, I'm going to start pen testing, but I know that, you know, there's a lot of legal aspects to it, and just in case, you know, the client doesn't have things backed up or there's something that just goes wrong, how well do you have to protect you and your pen testing team from a legal standpoint?
Well, that's a great point. And you know, I'm not a lawyer personally, but you know, all pen test companies and security companies, in fact, when you sign the contract, there is an indemnification there. Look, this is a best efforts basis. You know, it should be pointed out, first of all, though, that most pen tests, it's very rare that you take down a system. I've seen it happen maybe one out of 1,000 tests, so it does happen. And for that reason, we'll often say to a company, if you'd rather that we test outside of business hours, we're okay with that. In fact, WebCheck Security, that's kind of our modus operandi. We do a lot of our tests in between 5 p.m. and midnight when the load for the company is not going to be happening. unless it's a company where, hey, their load is in between those times or in the wee hours. But, you know, in the contracts, we make sure that there's an authorization to test. In other words, we specify the scope. Here's the scope. Here's when we're going to be testing. And we make sure that we cover ourselves that way with the legal contract. And then later on, we always have a professional kickoff call so that we can confirm the targets. I don't want to be hitting your website and testing it, Robbie, when I've engaged with XYZ Corporation. So I need to make sure I've got the targets right and the website's right. And then we make sure that they understand the window that we're testing in so that they can any firewall problems or often we'll ask them to take off some of their protections just during that window of time so we can quickly get in, do what we need to do, find the vulnerabilities that would be found if a hacker were to get in, document them so that they can fix them, and then they can turn their protections and whitelist back on. We protect ourselves through the statement of work, through the authorization to test, and even on the invoice, it's by paying us, you acknowledge that we're not responsible for business loss or system downtime, which rarely happens anyway.
Okay. Now, this is another question. In terms of cybersecurity insurance, I know that's a big thing right now. What kind of companies actually offer this kind of insurance? Because I got this asked once or twice by some people who listen to my podcast and who read my blog site, and I wasn't exactly sure. I mean, is it like the State Farms, like the Hiscox insurance companies, or are there companies that just specialize in cybersecurity?
You know, that's also great, an insightful question. You know, these days, everyone and their dog, as the expression goes, offers cybersecurity insurance. If you were to have asked that question a decade ago, it only would have been a few brokers specializing in it. But to be fair, even though you may go to your broker, your insurer, and say, "Hey, do you have a cyber policy?" "Oh yeah, we can get you a cyber policy." But the reality is, I have found, and I know this in working in various cyber companies, including WebCheck, and we've investigated and partnered with many companies. There are companies that specialize in cybersecurity that really have investigated it, have selected the appropriate carriers. Some of them are underwritten by Lloyd's of London, which is, of course, kind of the pièce de résistance of all insurers. And I would advise the listeners to really ask their insurer, do you specialize in cybersecurity? And they may try to bamboozle you a little bit, but you can quickly weed them out. Do you focus on cybersecurity for businesses? And I would, if not, I would find a company that does do that. For example, here locally in Utah, we work with some insurers. Hatch Insurance is one. The Levitt Insurance Group is another that works with cyber insurance. Hayes Insurance, also a nationwide insurer that that can specialize and has directors of cyber insurance product within that organization. So I would say, in fairness, to fully answer your question, not all, they may say they do cyber insurance, but there are really only a handful of carriers that specialize in it. And it makes sense to ask the question and find those carriers.
Okay. Now, I know as a pen tester, you know, not me as a pen tester, but, you know, as you find problems with the lines of defense of business, as you see, find, you know, gaps and weaknesses, you're supposed to document that. And at the end of the engagement, you're supposed to write a report for the client, you know, what they found and what you recommend patched up. Do you do that? Do you wait till the very end, or do you just kind of do it ad hoc where you just tell them when it happens? Or what I'm trying to get at, what if your pen testing team does find serious problems during the testing? How do you communicate that to the client? Is it written verbally at the end of the engagement hearing?
Yeah, that's a great question too, Ravi. And it, you know, not all pen test companies will do this. You know, some of them are paying guys that they just, "Hey, I'm doing my job, and I'm just going to do my test." I'm going to write down the results, and then I'll just forward them off to the project manager who will give them to the client. But we take an interest in the overall hygiene of a company's cybersecurity. So when we find what I would say medium and high risk vulnerabilities, meaning it may not be a systemic showstopper, but it may be something that's serious enough that a particular machine could be given root access to, or that something could be stolen, data could be exfiltrated, or something could be shut down or turned off, we're going to notify the client as we go. So, for example, Kurt and also Kelly, one of my other pen testers, as they're going through the project, you know, obviously they're taking screenshots, they're recreating the steps to how they got there, and then they're researching and or from their knowledge database in their heads saying, this is how we recommend you fix this problem. But they don't wait to give that particular report to the customer. They may forward that in an email and say, hey, here's some findings that you may want to start working on, particularly with web applications, because sometimes that involves opening a sprint or getting it on the docket for a development team to make it a priority. And so before we even finish the first draft of the penetration test, we'll make sure that as we find some of those showstoppers and some of those risks, that we're communicating them to the client and that we get a confirmation. Hey, did you get this email? Or we'll pick up the phone. Did you see this? Just so that they can start fixing those items. So no, we don't wait till the very end. We'll let them know as we go along.
Okay. What's the difference between internal and external penetration testing? I usually thought of penetration testing as testing from the outside environment going in, but I guess now you can actually do pen testing from the inside going out. Can you explain that in a little more detail?
Yeah, absolutely. So before I fully answer that question, you need to understand that, or our listening audience needs to understand that if a bad actor breaches the outside defenses through malware or through phishing, which is a common problem, another big discussion, they can be resident in the system for up to 200 days is the average before they're discovered, sometimes more. And within that time, here's the question, Robbie, is what will they find? How easy is it to break into the HR server? How easy is it to break into the video camera system, the alarm system, the databases that store sensitive data or health data or even credit card data? How easy is it to pivot laterally? And so an internal penetration test is designed to find those vulnerabilities, running tools and tests and scripts, as if you were sitting behind the firewall. And that's really the best way to describe it. So today, for example, I am conducting this podcast from my office. And so I have access internally. I'm authenticated to our Active Directory here at work. And I am able to, you know, if I wanted to start hacking around, then I would. I now have that internal view. I'm a spy. I'm one of the guys, right? I'm an agent, and so an internal pen test is done by sitting behind the firewall. Now, it's not always practical, and it's very expensive to fly a pen tester around the country. You know, I've got three pen testers, but we do tests in Toronto, Canada. We do tests in the UK. We do tests in Texas. We do tests in California. We might even do a test in Mexico or Germany. But we're not going to fly our pen testers out there. So rather what we do is we give them instructions to download a special Kali Linux build. So that's thing number one, or in some instances where there's not a certain level of sophistication or they don't have the right tools, then we'll actually just pre-configure a box that has all of the tools that we need. We'll ship it to them. They'll plug it internally to the network, and at the appropriate time, We'll have them turn that on and give us the okay to start testing. That will do, for example, a reverse SSH shell out to our tester, and our tester is then able to, without opening additional ports, authenticate in and start testing for those vulnerabilities. So very important, Robbie. It's finding those things behind the firewall. Obviously, it's a kind of testing that does require some authentication and some permissions. There are some companies that say, look, we're not going to open up. We're not going to do that kind of testing. We just want a strict black box test. We'll give you the external targets only, just see how far you can get. But it's always a best practice, in my opinion, to do an internal test as well, to just give us a little bit of leeway, a little bit of authentication. And that way, again, back to your earlier question, anything can be hacked, remember? So if we can find all of the low-hanging fruit internally that a hacker might find, were he to be in your system, or she, I guess, for 200 days, then that's what an internal pen test is designed to do.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, in cybersecurity, some of the big buzzwords now are machine learning, artificial intelligence. Do you use any of these tools for when you do pen testing, at least to help automate the routine tasks?
You know, there is some intelligence built into them. Most of them, with a really experienced pen tester, not so much big on the, you know, AI machine learning, because they already know what to do. They know how to hack into a system. There are scanners. I saw an ad the other day for automated penetration testing using artificial intelligence. You know, AI and machine learning, it's kind of the marketing buzzwords of the industry, so you have to be careful. Everybody has it now, right? But, you know, I really struggle with, unless you've actually built iRobot and it's a true artificial life form that can sit and process millions of if-thens and then, okay, I'm going to do this now. Okay, now I'm going to authenticate with this. Okay, it's just not out there yet. So, yeah, there is some machine learning out there. The tools are getting smarter. They're getting better. But at the same time, so are the hackers, because they have access to a lot of the tools. So AI scanners are really no substitute for an experienced pen tester that can wield the appropriate AI technology and apply it to the pen test environment. I hope that makes sense.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, I know that at least when I've interviewed some pen testing C-level execs like yourself, I think the cloak and dagger stories seem really exciting, like, you know, things that you've actually done. I know Alexander Jones, I think a couple of weeks ago, gave me some, he had some, you know, pretty exciting, you know, hair standing on your skin stories. And I think
right.
You've alluded to me that there's, yeah, I mean, kind of like James Bond in a way, right, you know. But you've alluded to me,
yes.
There's a story about a Mexican restaurant that was hacked into. Can you go into more detail, if you can, about that? Just kind of give our audience a little bit of a cloak and dagger story?
Sure, and if you're interested, I'll share a couple stories, both from things that we've found,
sure,
which are common problems that will benefit the listeners to know, as well as so the Mexican restaurant story. This is kind of it's an unfortunate one, but it's one that I repeat because it's illustrative of things that didn't have to have happened. Unfortunately, years ago I was employed with Security Metrics, which is a fine organization in the PCI community. They do QSA work. That's kind of where I started my career back in the day in Novell. There's a blast from the past, right? And in fact, became one of the first salespeople back when I was an account executive for that organization to certify as a certified network administrator. I wanted to have more in-depth knowledge of the network product that I was selling at the time. A lot of fun. But going forward, I hooked up with a fellow account executive, Brad Caldwell, back in the day. We'd met at a show in Toronto, and I was a rep, he was a rep, And years later, I won't tell his whole story, but he became the founder and CEO of what today is a very successful company in security metrics. Well, years later, I went to work for Brad and became one of his strategic account managers and later a business development strategic relations manager. And but along the way, I was fortunate to consult with businesses that had been breached. Now, most of these were small businesses, and when they were hacked, often Visa and MasterCard, if the card theft was enough, in other words, you know, it wasn't just 20 cards, it was 200 cards or 2,000 cards that fraud had initiated or originated from that particular restaurant. Then Visa and MasterCard would get in touch with the acquiring banks or the processors, in other words, and say, hey, these guys need to conduct a forensic investigation. So I would call these restaurants to advise them and offer the forensic services as an authorized forensic provider. Well, this Mexican restaurant was, it's typical of any good Mexican restaurant. It's been around for many years. People patronize it. You go in, you swipe your credit card on the POS system, and you don't think twice. You just enjoy that, you know, that chimichanga that you ordered with all the sour cream and guacamole. Well, unfortunately, fraud was linked to that particular site. They were hacked. They'd lost hundreds of cards over a period of time. MasterCard fined them $80,000. And, you know, for a small business, you know, let's say they've got a couple hundred thousand, 300,000 in revenue, maybe even $1 million in revenue, but to cough up a chunk of 80 grand at once and before they'll unfreeze your accounts, that killed them. Essentially, they declared bankruptcy, they closed up shop, and it put them out of business. So that's kind of the example of, had they been doing penetration tests and or even just scanning, they would have discovered that there were some vulnerabilities in the POS system or point-of-sale system that they were using. They would have fixed it, updated it, and chances are they might not have had to go through that exercise. They'd still be in business today. So that's kind of one of those FUD stories, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt surrounding cybersecurity. Kind of on a more proactive, positive side, here's some fun things that we found. Some time ago, we did a penetration test for a law firm, and our chief pen tester actually, and this was an external, not an internal test, but because of some vulnerabilities, he was able to gain internal access, broke into their video camera system. The video camera system happened to be looking at their filing system as well as their executive boardroom. So imagine all of the intellectual property. You can take pictures, screenshots of files. You can take pictures of things that they may have written on the whiteboard. So our pen tester actually took some screenshots and put it in the report and said, so you've got a problem, and here's the proof, and here are the vulnerabilities, and here's – that was kind of a fun one. They were shocked. They were horrified, but that's what they were paying us to do. And so they have since fixed that vulnerability. And incidentally, we've been able to gain access to video camera systems in several different organizations where we've ethically gone into hack, and they're very insecure. In another instance, here's another fun story. Our penetration tester broke into the HR server, was able to pull some executive salaries and Social Security numbers. Now, obviously, he didn't put the Social Security numbers in the report. He X'd them out. But he named the names and said, I was able to pull this data. Here's why. And this story is interesting because it was really – this was one of those internal pen tests where, again, you're pivoting around laterally inside the firewall to try and find, you know, if a hacker did get in because Sally clicked on a phishing link and invited malware in or gave up some credentials, what would that hacker be able to find during those 200 days? That's the average until they're discovered. So just so happened that one of the administrators that had root access to all of the HR data, put in a password that was like a very simple four-word password. So this is where one of those tools comes into play that we mentioned, Jack the Ripper or Nikto, and our tester was able to discern the password and get in and authenticate into the HR server, pull the socials and the, you know, the CEO and the salaries, and that's kind of a fun story. Obviously, they fixed that. They upgraded their passwords. They've implemented two-factor authentication. And so that stuff's really out there. You think you're secure, but the first time you've missed a little hole where you can pour the water through, then it's over, right? Tales from
right.
the crypt.
Gotcha. Well, in that regard, what kind of who's your typical customer base? I'm not asking you to give names or anything, but like, who do you target for customers? I mean, what's your typical customer base profile?
Well, first of all, you know, it's just best security practice to get a penetration test. So on that note, it really spans so many different industries and so many verticals. But I see a lot of common elements. I see there's healthcare organizations. One of our repeat clients is a SaaS, a healthcare SaaS company. So obviously they provide systems that touch PII, and they need to make sure that web application system that they're providing is secure. So we obviously, Ravi, we see a lot of healthcare organizations that will purchase an annual penetration test and do scanning. The PCI industry, anybody who is not necessarily the smaller merchants these days, because they can implement point-to-point encrypted point of sale systems where, you know, you swipe the card and at the hardware it encrypts the card data, and they don't have the key to decrypt it, the processor does. And so that, you know, there's more and more of those but you get into some of the larger merchant environments or the service providers servicing them that have massive or high production infrastructure where card data is traversing it and being stored in databases. And they need to have penetration tests. So card processors and banks and service providers, we get a lot of those. We also tend to get, you know, in general, SaaS companies that are providing a service. They need to understand where the flaws are. They're constantly updating and changing and upgrading. So they'll run at least quarterly scans as well as tests. Data centers and infrastructure providers will engage us, and really any large corporation, typically over, you know, and everybody should do it, but I typically see that anything over a $10 million organization will hire us to do at least an external pen test to ensure that they're secure.
Okay. Now, we know that compliance, you know, especially with the implementation of GDPR, is now becoming a must for, you know, businesses and corporations of all kinds and types. You've listed out a bunch of compliance, like PCI, SOC, HIPAA. Can you elaborate more on that? I mean, do you have to be compliant with them, or is it your client that has to be compliant, or both of you? Can you get in a little bit more detail for that?
You bet. So you mentioned GDPR. So let's start with that. That's kind of a unique beast, if you will. Most of our listening audience has probably heard of that. There may be a few of them that don't. So I'll just spell it out. It's the General Data Privacy Regulation, and it was initiated by the European Union to protect European Union residents' PII. Europe is a little bit more progressive in terms of giving its citizens privacy rights as technology is concerned. And so this legislation basically can levy massive fines of millions of dollars or up to a certain percentage of revenue, of their global revenue, that is, in fines if they're found to be grossly out of compliant, or if the PII breach was significant enough And we've actually seen some of those fines levied recently. As GDPR is now, I believe it came into play in May of 2018. So you're now seeing some of the first fines being levied to larger corporations. But here's the problem, Ravi, is let's say you are a small SaaS provider and you have, and I'm just making this up, but let's say you have a hotel a lobby registration system that you sell to inns and hostels and bed and breakfasts throughout North America, but also you've got some European clients. Well, guess what? Your system now touches EU citizens' private data, their addresses, their phone numbers, maybe genders or birth dates, or you know, if a database has religious information, and that's considered privacy data according to GDPR as well. And GDPR says, hey, these citizens have rights. They have the right to be forgotten or the right to be removed from your system. You have to have justification for having them in your system. You have to have the proper privacy controls or security controls in the system. Do you have those? So while GDPR isn't really designed to be a cybersecurity framework like NIST or ISO 27001 or PCI, it does specify what the general regulations are. You think of it as HIPAA. HIPAA applies in the United States to your healthcare data specifically for U.S. citizens, and where GDPR is all private data for European citizens. So back to your original question, GDPR is important, and where that plays into penetration testing is that any organization who then touches EU data or services organizations that may touch that data, they have to consider GDPR, whether or not they are GDPR compliant. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Now, what about some of the others like the ISO, FedRAMP, HITRUST?
Yeah, you bet. And so so those are all cybersecurity compliances and or frameworks that may be required by various organizations. For example, everybody knows on this call what HIPAA is. We just mentioned that. But what if you are a service provider? You're providing, for example, a practice management for large healthcare clinics. If one of your clients is Anthem or Blue Cross, or Health Corporation of America, some of the biggies, those organizations actually started kind of a HIPAA on steroids compliance framework called HITRUST. And HITRUST is based on a lot of the ISO 27001 principles, and we'll talk about that beast in a minute. It's based on NIST. It's based on a lot of the general security frameworks that are reputable. And to become HITRUST compliant means that you pass a certification by a certified authorized auditor that says, hey, you know, we've audited you, we bless you, we give you this certificate that's good, you know, for maybe 2 years, and you have to renew that. So that's HITRUST. It's a very specific healthcare compliance. And if you're dealing with the big boys, then chances are they'll ask you to do that. That's the thing, Ravi. A lot of these compliances, they're really driven by the market. If you're doing business in Europe and you're a large corporation providing services where data and security are involved, they may ask you to be ISO 27001 compliant. ISO 27001 provides for something called an ISMS, an Information Security Management System. And what that is, it's a layer of policy, procedure, oversight, and continual improvement that is kind of indicative of a mature cyber or an organization that has a cyber maturity. Does that make sense? And so ISO is becoming more and more accepted in the U.S., and large corporations mostly are asked to do that if they're going to be touching sensitive data or doing business with clients in Europe or even now in the U.S. Other U.S. clients will ask their vendors to be ISO certified. So there's that. Ultimately, though, Robbie, a lot of it comes from NIST, which is run in the United States. The FedRAMP and FISMA regulations, they're specific to vendors that are doing business with the federal government. FISMA is kind of a NIST-derived general security framework that says, hey, we are secure. If you are providing government cloud services, either infrastructure or particularly SaaS, or you're providing data storage, let me give you an example of that. We've mentioned it before, Amazon. Amazon obviously hosts data. If they do it for the government, and where it's particularly sensitive data, they have to be FedRAMP certified. And FedRAMP is kind of the granddaddy of all difficulties in terms of certification. So there's that. And, you know, maybe another time we can do a complete, we can even do a whole show on this because compliance is
security
are, you know, it's broad and we can go as deep as you want. And then there's PCI. Of course, everybody, PCI touches everybody's lives. It's the payment card industry standard run by the PCI Data Security Council. And it's designed by, you know, Visa and MasterCard and Amex back in 2005, took their programs and spun off the PCI Council. And in 2006, you had this fully formed, self-governing private organization that worked with the card brands and the acquiring banks to make sure that processors and merchants were secure. Hence, your card, Ravi, and my credit card and debit cards are hopefully secure if merchants and service providers are following the PCI framework, which seeks to define the cardholder data environment and secure it through encryption and all kinds of controls that are appropriate to that environment. So I don't know what else you want to talk about with regards to that, but lots of different compliance frameworks. I guess in summary, if you know, an organization, if they don't have a good cybersecurity plan or they're looking to mature their cybersecurity plan, you know, obviously penetration testing should be a part of that at least annually, but they can look to standards like NIST or like the CIS 20, the Center for Internet Security. The top 20 critical controls is what it's called, and if they can at least do the top six, they will be a lot more cyber mature than an organization who hasn't gone through a framework like that and begun to check those boxes.
Gotcha. Now this question is kind of off the cuff, but I'm going to go ahead and ask anyway. Has your team ever done anything with the dark web? I mean, that's going to be one of the chapters in our new book, but I get asked about that quite a bit, you know, and I guess people associate that with pen testing because they think that, you know, usernames, passwords, they all are like, we're still on the dark web, which is true, but have you ever penetrated dark web or have you ever done any work on it before? Or?
Yeah, well, typically you're not penetrating the dark web because your clients aren't in the dark web, but their
right,
data
right.
may be. And it's being pawned, or another term is pwned. It's being sold by underground organizations and nefarious individuals, and you have to have a special browser to get into the dark web. I don't sell services there. There are some organizations that's kind of their thing is they'll sell reconnaissance services where they'll look to see if some of your critical data is out there on the dark web, so they'll use scanners and different tools to do that. Kurt, my you know, VP of technology, he's been out there, and he knows how to get out there, but he doesn't spend a lot of time out there. Mostly he's doing the ethical light side hacking, not the hacking on the upside down, to use a metaphor from Stranger Things.
Right, okay, cool. Now, let's just talk about the cybers. Now, let's kind of go into the cybersecurity threat landscape in general. One thing that I keep getting asked, and I ask all my podcast guests, are what do you think the biggest cybersecurity threat is going to be this year or coming in 2020 now that we're halfway through this year? You know, we keep hearing about ransomware, you know, crypto mining, crypto jacking, you know, and different variants of phishing. I mean, phishing is like the oldest form of cyber attack, but still pretty prevalent, you know, BEC, business email compromise. Being a cybersecurity professional yourself with your own company, what do you think is going to be the biggest threat or threats out there? And how do you see this landscape changing in the coming next year and a half?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's really easy. It's phishing. If we could fire all of our employees and every company everywhere, then we wouldn't have cybersecurity problems, would we? But the reality is you can't do that, and people are going to click on stuff, on things. And that's the challenge. There are some really good products out there that can detect based on a number of factors when an email is bad, because these schemes and scams kind of repeat themselves. So, you know, you take some of the great endpoint technologies and, you know, the spam firewalls that are out there, like Mimecast, and even some of the endpoint tools like Sophos and CrowdStrike and Carbon Black, DarkTrace. They may see things, but, you know, if I'm going to click on a very carefully crafted DocuSign link that's not really a DocuSign link, you know, and volunteer up my credentials, and they happen to be the same credentials that I use for my system, now a hacker has full authentication rights into critical systems potentially. So really, hands down, what has emerged as the greatest threat to the cyber world is good old phishing and human error. And so I think, you know, that's going to continue to be the case, and it's only getting worse. I think that what that means, Ravi, is that one of the key things that an organization can do is to train their employees. And in fact, that's kind of given rise to a small but a new industry, and I think this is kind of where that's going. To combat that, organizations are going to have to start deploying training and learning platforms where they can monitor and gauge the success of the training that's being delivered. And this is not meant to be a sales pitch, but we came upon an organization recently at WebCheck Security that we were so impressed with. I happen to have known these guys for many years. They used to be big in the PCI world, and they'd created a PCI learning platform for larger organizations and for processors to give to their level 4 merchants so that they could train them and they could pass their PCI compliance. But they realized that with the whole phishing thing, that it's applicable to all organizations everywhere, and so they changed their name from PCI University to Data Security University. And in fact, at WebCheck, we now have a partnership with them where we can provide that platform to our clients. And essentially what it is it allows all employees, let's say you've got 1,000 employees in an organization, maybe you've only got 50 employees, but they need to be trained and reminded at least quarterly of the danger that's out there. So it will walk them through rich video content, questions. They have to take a little test at the end, and it allows the administrators to then go in and see where they're falling down and who's failing. It'll even do little phishing tests to see who's clicking on things that they shouldn't. So that's the biggest threat, Ravi. One of those tales from the crypt. The other company that I affiliate with, Secuvom, that runs the full security managed detection response or SOC services, one of their clients clicked on a DocuSign link, and it happened to be the IT director, but he was closing on a house. And he thought that it was a real thing. Somebody very clever outside the organization may have been listening outside the firewall. You can't really control that. You can control what's in your firewall, though, as we've suggested. But he clicked on the link. As soon as the malware started coming into the system, the Secuvom analysts were able to see the bad bytes in the packet, fortunately, because of the technology and the SOC monitoring tools and the SIM and the logs. They were able to piece that together, call the client and say, hey, you got a problem. Here's how to shut it down. But that continues, again, to remain a threat. Even IT directors, as we see from this story, are going to click on bad stuff once in a while. So we need to be vigilant. We need to have learning processes in place, and we need to make sure our employees are trained. Just if you don't understand it, you don't know what it is, don't click on the link, don't click on attachments that you don't know what they are. Better to have someone pick up the phone and say, hey, did you send this? Or someone say, hey, I sent you an attachment, but you never got it. And do kind of the dual factor verification before you introduce malware into the system. But that's the biggest threat, is the human component.
I've got an interesting story put on the IT director slant. I was a contract tech writer a couple of years ago, actually, for Blue Cross Blue Shield. And during that time, Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield was hit by a major cyber attack. And the boss...
I remember that.
My boss was the IT director, and he was in the hot seat for quite a while. I think he ended up resigning just so that, you know, he wouldn't get a bad name or something. So that was kind of interesting at the time. But finally, as we wrap up our show, one thing, again, I keep getting asked to ask all my guests is probably a $60,000 question. What do you recommend to businesses and clients to protect themselves from being a victim of cyber attack in general? Like, give a laundry list of the top 3 or 4 tips that you offer, or what do you recommend?
Well, and again, what I would recommend in general to not just our clients, but any of our clients, is obviously having an annual pen test is not enough. A pen test is an ethical, kind, benevolent hacker, obviously finding where the holes are. So that's important, but it really goes a lot beyond that. So what I would ask our clients or anyone to do is go out to cissecurity.org and /controls and take a look at, download the CIS top 10 controls and at least knock off the first 5 or at least begin to do that. And you know, that's pretty comprehensive. I would also make sure that you're doing some of the basic hygiene things. Have you, like, for example, run or have your technical folks run a simple Nmap scan to find all the open ports, and then you question, why are these open? Do they need to be open? Obviously, 80 and 443 for your web stuff, and you've got things like file transfer protocol, maybe port 21 and 22 for SSH, and you know, but why is port 135 open? And what about port 143? Does it need to be open? Well, IMAP goes through 143, so probably it does. But anyway, I don't want to get too much of a technical deep dive there, but that would be my recommendation, Robbie, just in a nutshell, is download the CIS 20 and begin to knock those out, at least the top 6. And if you can do that, your cyber hygiene will be so much better than it was before. If you need help doing that at WebCheck Security, we of course have experts that can advise, and of course we can run tests on your infrastructure to ensure that you are in fact safe.
Okay. Well, Greg, we thank you so much for your time this Saturday afternoon, and we look forward to having you on a future podcast. I think we've got some great topics we can continue our further discussion on, especially on the compliance issues.
Well, my pleasure, Robbie. It's been a pleasure to be here. I hope there was some value for your listeners, and I'm happy to
definitely
do it again.
Okay. Take care. Have a great afternoon.
All right. Bye now.
Bye.